On the Beach is an apocalyptic novel by Neville Shute, published by William Morrow & Company, New York, New York, 1957. It is set in a fictional Australia during the late 1950s in the aftermath of a nuclear war. The principal characters are Commander Dwight Towers, an heroic captain of the USS Scorpion, Moira Davidson, Towers' heavy-drinking female companion, Lieutenant Peter Holmes, Australian liaison to the Scorpion, Mary Holmes, Peter Holmes's wife, and John Osborne, a civilian radiation scientist assigned to the Scorpion. Written during the 1950s at the height of the Cold War, Neville Shute's On the Beach depicts the aftermath of a nuclear holocaust. As survivors in Australia await imminent death from fallout, some meet their fates with dignity and others with dread. On the Beach thus delves compassionately but forcefully into the human psyche, and while many of Shute's characters ultimately fail to attain a state of grace, their anger and sorrow are nevertheless profound. Perhaps then Shute's purpose in portraying his characters so vividly is to paint nuclear war as a possibility so repellent as to be unthinkable. Presumably, all life in the Northern Hemisphere had been destroyed a few years earlier by nuclear detonations and radioactive fallout. Survivors in Australia now awaited the inevitable arrival of the billowing mists of fallout that would eventually kill them. Peter Holmes, a lieutenant in the Australian Navy, had been reassigned as a liaison officer on the USS Scorpion, a former American submarine that had come under Australian command after America's annihilation. Holmes's new commanding officer, Commander Dwight Towers, was a soft-spoken man who, like most displaced Americans in Australia, kept to himself. Thus, in a gesture of goodwill, Holmes invited the commander to stay the weekend at his oceanside home south of Melbourne. At first, Dwight was disinclined to undertake even the most casual of friendships, as he was about to embark on a long and dangerous research mission up north. Finally, however, he decided to accept the invitation. When they arrived at Holmes's house, Peter introduced Dwight to his wife Mary and to Moira Davidson, a boisterous single young woman who drank to excess in order to escape from the war's painful effects. Dwight, nevertheless, soon developed a very close relationship with Moira. In truth, grief-stricken over the loss of his family in Connecticut, Dwight's pain was every bit as intense as Moira's. His wife and family were very real to him, more real by far than the half-life in a far corner of the world that had been forced upon him since the war. The devastation of the Northern Hemisphere was not real to him, as it was not real to her. He had seen nothing of the destruction of the war, as she had not. In thinking of his wife and of his home, it was impossible for him to visualize them in any other circumstances than those in which he had left them. He had little imagination, and that formed a solid core for his contentment in Australia. In Dwight's eyes, then, his wife and children were still alive. "I suppose you think I'm nuts," he once remarked to Moira, "but that's the way I see it, and I can't seem to think about it any other way." Moira, of course, understood. As it happened, Moira's cousin, John Osborne, had also been assigned to the Scorpion as a civilian radiation specialist. The Australian government intended to send the submarine to the Northern Hemisphere to measure radiation levels and to investigate the source of some recently received radio signals. Transmitted from the Seattle area, the infrequent signals indicated that someone might have survived the nuclear devastation. Although John felt flattered that the Navy had recruited him for such important work, he wanted to stay in Australia for a reason that once might have seemed petty, to work on the Ferrari he had purchased from an elderly widow. For John, the race car, which ran on a methanol derivative rather than ever scarcer petrol, diverted his thoughts from the radiation which was gradually moving southward. Moreover, a lively amateur racing club had sprung up in Melbourne, and the prospects of speeding around curves with other equally reckless drivers invigorated him. Even dying in a fiery collision was preferable to succumbing to painful radiation poisoning. Finally, however, John, Dwight, and Peter were ordered to board the submarine for its northern mission. Both Mary and Moira were left with the fear that they would never again see the men they loved. In fact, before Peter left, he also became quite worried and advised his wife what to do in the event of his death if she and their baby became caught in radiation's grasp. She was to give the baby a lethal injection and then take one of the lethal red pills. "I think you're crazy," Mary shot back at him in disgust. "If you say one more word, I'll murder you." Now it was John's turn to lash out in anger. Staring fiercely at his wife, he murmured, "This is a time when you've just got to show some guts and face up to things." Later, Mary told him, sobbing, "Oh, Peter, I'm sorry I've been such a fool." Still, she could not really accept the fact that they were all going to die by summer's end. She would simply tend her garden and try to save her life until her husband's return. In contrast, Moira had come to grips with the inevitable, but longed to have more time with Dwight before their lives ended. Now, however, she sensed that she would not see him again. Keeping her feelings to herself, however, Moira, in saying goodbye, tried to ease Dwight's mind about the submarine's dangerous mission. Moira, feeling forsaken, stayed with Mary for a while and then went to her parents' farm, where she thought the chores would provide a distraction. Since beginning her relationship with Dwight, Moira had taken control of her life. She had curtailed her drinking and had even enrolled in a secretarial class at the local university. Meanwhile, the farther north the submarine went, the more restless became its crew. Even after staying submerged for 2 weeks, the men did not dare to step onto the bridge when they surfaced because of the high radiation levels. When the submarine finally approached the American coast near Seattle, the crew hoisted the periscope to survey what remained of the small suburb of Edmonds, 15 miles north of the city. Suddenly a sailor, an Edmonds native named Lieutenant Swain, disappeared through a rear escape hatch and began swimming toward his hometown. Stunned, the crew watched Swain emerge from the water, climb the rocks, and disappear among a cluster of houses. Dwight, in fact, knew that he likely would react similarly if the sub had been sent to Mystic, Connecticut, where he had last seen his own family. Later, as the submarine entered the region of Puget Sound, near where the radio transmissions had originated, John Osborne was fitted into a radiation suit equipped with 2 hours of air and sent ashore to inspect the radio station. He found no survivors. Someone had apparently left a transmitter on, and an open window pane, slapped by occasional gusts of wind, had activated the switch panel. After this disappointing discovery, the crew set course to test radiation levels further north. Near the Alaskan shoreline, they found the levels to be consistently lethal, disproving a popular theory that the fallout gradually was being filtered out of the atmosphere as it blew toward the polar ice caps. Now there was no hope for survival, either on land or at sea. The submarine headed southward on its long journey back to Australia. After Dwight and Moira were reunited, however, their relationship quickly began to deteriorate. As Dwight continued to grieve for his dead family, Moira slowly came to realize that she would never marry and have children. For her, the end had already come. Peter and Mary, on the other hand, coped with their impending fate by retreating into themselves, focusing only on their home, their garden, their baby, and the deep love they felt for one another. They planted seeds in the sterile earth, even though they knew they would never germinate. Australians, in single-minded reverence, savored each day. Before long, the ever-advancing death tide would overtake them. John Osborne, for one, persisted in fixing up his Ferrari, the glimmering sports car that would carry him to death in the upcoming Grand Prix. Now radio broadcasts reported that the southward seepage of radiation had quickened. The end of life on Earth, once calculated for September, would actually come sometime around the end of August. And, as predicted, one by one the cities of the Southern Hemisphere, Rio, Cape Town, Sydney, blacked out as their remaining inhabitants perished. Now there was only Melbourne. The lone Australian station, still sending out newscasts, saw a certain bitter irony in the continent's plight. the pesky rabbits that had long plagued Australia's countryside and escaped all attempts at eradication, would outlive human beings by at least a year. As radiation sickness beset Melbourne's remaining inhabitants, the red suicide pills began to appear free of charge in all the local pharmacies. In fact, when Moira's parents became gravely ill, the older couple ended their lives with the pills. As the days passed, Dwight, who had finally come to terms with his wife and children's deaths and had taken many pleasant outings with Moira, decided to release the Scorpion from its moorings and sink it out beyond the end of the bay. Under skies that were already turning an unnatural color of gray, he bid Moira a tearful goodbye. And as the Scorpion made its way out of port, Dwight emerged from the below deck and walked out onto the bridge. Moira, standing on the gangway, looked on as if in a trance. So this was the end. She watched as the lower end of the gangway was released, as the lines were singled up, watched the water swirl beneath her stern as the propellers ran slow ahead and the stern swung out. Only Dwight, with one other, was left on the bridge. He lifted his hand in salutation to her, and she lifted hers to him, her eyes blurred with tears, and the low hull of the vessel swung away around Point Gellibrand and vanished in the murk. Moira drove her car carelessly around the tip of the point and parked in a spot overlooking a cliff, where she continued watching the submarine as it glided out of the bay and finally plunged out of view. She looked at her little wristwatch. It showed 1:01. Her childhood religion came back to her in those last minutes. One ought to do something about that, she thought. A little alcoholically, she murmured the Lord's Prayer. Then, closing her eyes, she took the pill in her palm, put it to her mouth, and swallowed for the last time. John Osborne later triumphed in his Grand Prix race, but to his disappointment did not suffer the heroic death he had planned. He retired to his shop to do a final tune-up on his Ferrari. Afterwards, he donned his racing suit and goggles, and then he, too, popped a red pill into his mouth. Waiting for death together at home, Mary and Peter Holmes had made peace with reality. When they finally became too weak to go on, they enjoyed one last cup of tea. Then Peter prepared the syringe, gave the baby her shot, and extracted two pills. "I've had a lovely time since we got married," Mary said gently, touching his arm. "I've had a grand time, too," he replied, kissing her. "Let's end on that."